Welcome to today's programming languages. After last time's short interlude with prototype-based programming, we are going to look at the next topic, and this is now approaching the topic of metaprogramming, and one particular kind of metaprogramming is what we're going to look at today, which is aspect-oriented programming. So maybe first of all, is there anyone in the room who has already had some contact with aspect-oriented programming? Oh, wow. I think you're one of a kind during my whole career here. Yeah, so it seems that aspect-oriented programming has been like more popular like 10 years ago, and by now it has become like a niche product in that sense. But have you done active development in that?
Yeah.
So did you do a clean start, or was it like attaching to a legacy system? Oh, okay. Wow. That's for sure something I have not heard in here before. Anyway, so aspect-oriented programming. That's it? Yeah. So far we have had a look at ways to modularize our software with like in-language concepts, as classes, with objects, with mix-ins, with traits, and all that. And there's also other approaches that don't follow this like modular concept as we have seen so far. So this is what we're going to see today. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at how aspect-oriented programming is motivated and what the basics of weaving are. Then we're going to have a look at how to implement our new software organizing principles in what we call then aspects, and how we can bring them in connection with non-aspect code. That's what we're going to do in this second part here, bundling aspects and static cross-cutting. We're going to talk about the expressivity, what is there in terms of what possible join points are, how point cuts are specified, and what kind of advice I can provide around point cuts. We're going to have a look at how point cut designators look like and how we can compose them to some more complex point cuts, and going to have a look at how advices and point cuts are actually implemented. So the first thing is that, well, so far we have seen a lot of approaches to modularization by translating modules directly into code blocks of some sorts. What we're going to see in this particular topic is what we call aspects, which can be thought of as some concern of your functionality that is in that sense not placed into just one particular entity in your design, but is somehow distributed over your hierarchy. Here it's called smeared over all your modules, but you can imagine that the functionality is in that sense not in one particular part centered, but it's like distributed all over. And in that sense, it's, well, some people consider that as quite difficult to maintain and would like to pull that out of all the places where it has been distributed to and keep it in one central facility in order to develop and to keep it somehow bug-free. So they like to focus on not these different code blocks where the functionality can lie, but on the all these pieces that plug in everywhere, which we then call these aspects of concern. And this is what aspect-oriented programming is about. So in aspect-oriented programming, we express a few of the system's aspects particularly the ones that concern or that are cross-cutting the modules that are distributed all over your program, and express them in these so-called aspects, and have an automatic facility weave them into the software that you're writing. So we let some automated process distribute the functionality over our hierarchy for us. And that is what is called the weaver in object, in aspect-oriented programming. So you can maybe visualize that in your traditional approach, where you do the functional decomposition of your software in several entities, which would be like functions or even objects, and they can exist, or they are specified independently from each other, and the compiler then adds them to the final program, and there they remain in that kind of almost separated state and only have some well-defined interfaces between each other. In aspect-oriented decomposition, what you do is you formulate certain properties of your software in these aspects, each of them forming like one entity, one unit, and have the aspect weaver weave them into the program, in the sense that later on in the final product you will see that there are parts of the blue aspect woven together with parts of this red aspect and parts of the green aspect, all together forming some kind of program. Usually, well, I don't know how, for example, you did it with your particular approach. I would assume that there's still some kind of object-oriented carrier underneath where you would add the aspect later on, isn't there?
Yeah, there were like classes and you use basically pointers to intercept the methods in the class.
Okay, so it's not a like either-or solution, but what you usually have is some central functionality that still keeps to like your plain old object-oriented code, and then add to it with specifying new aspects and let them be woven into the final code. So, typical applications for that. Well, was it logging for you? Yeah, see. That's one of the typical uses for that. So this is usually functionality that is found all over the place, particularly if you're like developing and do a lot of this print line debugging, then you easily switch over from print line debugging to like have some logging server running somewhere and distribute your communication with the logging server throughout the complete program. And this is a thing that we would consider a typical use case for aspect-oriented programming, where you have cluttered all your programs, all your hierarchical designs with a particular aspect of concern, which would be, I would like to know what's going on, I would like to log what's happening, and this would be a candidate for moving over into an aspect and not cluttering the rest of the program anymore. Other concerns are like, well, error handling. If there is something that you can formalize with some description of some sorts, then you might be able to pull that out into a particular aspect and not bother throughout your program with certain error handling things that reappear all the time throughout your program. So this is a thing that might be, implemented with an aspect. Then there is certain security things. I think the prominent example for that was like these SQL injection thingies. So there are certain things that have a particular pattern for communication with your database server, and in order to strengthen the way that custom substrings are put into the SQL communication in there, you would usually find a particular sequence of calls, I think it was, in that sense, that that would modify the underlying string. And this is a thing that needed to be, well, you need to add some escaping characters into the certain strings that can be influenced from the outside. And this is one of the aspects that also was a nice example for keeping in an external aspect and not bothering the actual program with having to keep up with all the time escaping your SQL strings. And yeah, in that sense was like one of the success stories in there. There's also things like validation of inputs or profiling and all that. So these are typical things that follow a particular principle but don't necessarily only appear at one particular point in your program but might be distributed all over, thus being a cross-cutting concern in that sense. So, yeah, one example, well, for my part, that is the major example that made it to some fame, at least. I don't recall that the C++ and the other aspect-oriented engines have gained a lot of followers, so AspectJ was in that sense the most prominent the most prominent engine to be used for that. So that's what we're going to see in the next few slides. So the first thing that was or came with aspect-oriented program was what was called static cross-cutting. So this had, for example, the feature of adding so-called external definitions to already existing classes. And this is a thing that is not overly complicated. So I have an example here. There's a simplistic hierarchical data structure for expressions that would inherit from a base class expression and would have composite expressions like add or nodes in our tree like the const thing, and yeah, we can build up trees with that. And we would feature what we call here an aspect, and it's formulated pretty similar to what a class looks like. So it's produced with aspect, gets a name, and then you can go wild with your definitions in there. And one of the things that you can add in this is an external definition which looks like the things over here. So this first line would add an external definition to our class hierarchy. Particularly, it would add the eval function into class expression in abstract state. So with that being present, the weaver would take care of that the expression would have an abstract eval function. Then there's other abstract function, other external definitions, like those two, which would be actual implementations of the formally introduced abstract eval, one for const and one for add. And there you would specify how the actual evaluation would look like. And this is a functionality that you could very well also add to your concrete classes, of course, but with that you would then distribute your implementation throughout several classes. Here it's not overly bad because those are quite closely related anyway, and they all inherit from the same base class. But in principle, what you have in common for all of those is that you do some kind of computation that you might to do in a like consistent way throughout all your thing. And if you change something in the way that you perform your computations, you might have to touch all the other classes where there are implementations for eval. Thus, you might consider it to be much more comfortable to have them grouped into just one thing, and that is what the aspect would serve for here. So this is one way of extracting an aspect from your class hierarchy into one central place and keep them there. The equivalent code that, well, if the Weaver would produce, for example, first another round of Java code before it then goes through the actual Java C compiler, could then look like the following, where you have this abstract thing here and the evals just inlined into the actual bodies of the classes, so no major magic going on in here. And although the first implementations of AspectJ produced or had the option of going the way through producing another round of Java code before everything is given to the compiler, this is not necessarily the case. You can also directly emit the Java bytecode from the Weaver by, well, first translating the old version and then have them patched later on with the bytecode generated from the actual aspect. And I think this is also the prevalent way of doing your weaving at the moment. Anyway, this is not overly interesting. These are things that are similarly done also with other approaches. Particularly, we have heard about like these extension methods last time, where we could do like similar things like attaching functionality from some external location to something already existing. And yeah, so this is not overly exciting, I guess. So what else came was dynamic cross-cutting, and this is now a little bit more complicated, so I have to introduce a few terms for you. So first of all, we need to talk about so-called join points. So in order to somehow interfere with the way that a particular program runs on the machine, and in order to modify the way that it runs, there needs to be some means of defining the, let's call it points of interest, where you can actually interject the run of the program and inject your own code before the original execution is continued. And in order to do so, you need some way of actually really finding unique points that you can really identify, even though the program has run through a compiling phase, like Java C does. And on the way from the source code to the target code, there is a certain loss of orientation, in the sense that not every high-level construct can be easily identified in the low-level representation anymore. So you need some kind of, some well-known patterns that you can easily identify within the produced class code, for example, that you can map back to high-level language features. And these are then patterns or language features that you can use for specifying callbacks through your aspects, advices, and have them execute at a well-defined point in your program flow. And this is what these join points are all about. These are well-known patterns that we can easily locate in a bytecode file that can be mapped back to some high-level language feature. So what are typical features that we can find in the bytecode? Well, for example, when you can pretty easily find a start and endpoint for the execution of an actual method call. So method has a well-defined start and end in the class file, and this is then for the first type of join points that we consider. So, this is what we call this method or constructor call. Beneath that, you find a very similar sounding thing, which is this method or constructor execution, and well, they sound pretty similar, so they are kind of related. Which one is which? Well, the call has to do with like the calling expression. So this means that this is the point in the program flow where you are still at the statement that expresses that the method is gonna be called, whereas with the actual execution, you in principle already are located in the frame of the callee and at the start of the actual method to be called. And why are they so different? I mean, they are pretty close in succession. First, you run through the actual method called expression, then you're immediately dispatched to the method execution. So, yeah, they are in direct succession. One is before the dispatch, one is after the dispatch. Why is there such a big fuss about keeping them separate? Well, it has to do with the way that the call or the execution can be specified. Both of them are specified in terms of their static signature. And since we have already had this topic about dispatching, the static signature of the method call can be quite different from the actual static signature of the method that is then dispatched to. Both of them might differ from each other depending on what overriding of your methods has done or how the parameters are specialized and all that. So they are not necessarily the same thing, and in order to provide both of these specifications and to introduce join points for both situations, they are kept apart from each other. Other quite easily discernible situations are the ones that are related to setting or getting fields or attributes. So these are easily identifiable in the bytecode again. So these are also considered to be join points that can be attributed with callbacks. Then exception handler execution is also pretty easily found in the bytecode. So this is also a thing that can be trapped. And then there is like the initialization phases, like the class initialization or the object initializations. So there is usually these. The constructor for one part, but also like the class constructor. I don't know whether you know that one with the static and the curly brackets, but this is a way of configuring how static attributes of your class are supposed to look like whenever the class loader loads your class, and these can also be easily located in bytecode files. So they all are different join points that can be found easily in the bytecode, and thus are considered to be valid join points to attach your own methods to. So, in order to specify what we want, what join point we want to target, because clearly when we run a program, there are a lot of join points passed, and we only are interested in particular ones. For that, we need some kind of language of specifying what the target of our aspect should actually look like. And therefore, we need so-called point cut specifications. And yeah, this is this specification is done with particular syntax. So this is what you see over here. So we start by just claiming that we start with a with point cut with a keyword, and then we give the whole thing a particular name with this ID thingy, and then optionally add a few identifiers with that. What would we need that for? Well, this is in order to specify a few variables that we might use within our callback code for that particular join point, but more on that later. We don't necessarily need them right away, but we'll introduce them by need later on. And then we continue with like this colon here, and then we have the expression that then specifies how the actual point cut looks like, and we see that this is like a whole. This is not just one particular expression, but you can make more complex ones by building them up from a few basic expressions, so you can have certain conditions for whether you want that particular point cut being selected or not. And all boils down into that we know we have to at some point reach what we call a primitive point cut designator, and these are pretty much all these different items that we have talked about earlier on, like this method call or method execution and all that. So these are the primitive entities in there, and we can connect them with each other. How can we do so? Well, we have an example down there. So this is this guy over here. So this specifies the point cut DFS, and it triggers on composite point cut designation, which consists of an alternation, so either or. Either we execute tree.dfs or leaf.dfs. And yeah, so these guys here are considered to be like primitive point cut designators, and we will see which ones there are a little bit later on. For now, what we have to take away is that there is a way of specifying how we want to weave our code into some carrier code by using a point cut designator that we can name somehow, and then we can describe the points where we want to interject our code by giving certain primitive point cut designators. So far, we haven't talked about what code we want to insert then into our program. And for that, we also need some means of doing so. So this is all about advice now. With advice, we can specify the actual code that we want to weave into our target code at certain point cuts. And we do so by providing a scope together with point cut designator and some kind of modifier from this list here. So there is this specification of before or after, after returning or after throwing. And with that you can fill the aspect, like this aspect doubler here, with certain advices. An advice consists in one of these blocks in there, so the thing that starts with this before and ends with actually that curly bracket over here, and the thing in this part here is the actual advice. So this is the code that is then woven into the target program. Where does it attach to? This is what is specified by the point cut designator in here. Here we have an explicit one that is formulated as a particular call to a particular signature, but we could also have used the name that we have given a point cut a little bit earlier on. So either you specify it as a direct specification of a point cut, or you use the name that you have introduced earlier on. And now there's still the question of, well, if I have a particular event happening, like a call of a particular method, this is still not clear whether I want my advice to be executed before the actual event is happening or after the actual event is happening. And this is what this before and after things are all about. And this is what is specified here. So this particular advice is to be executed before the event belonging to the point cut here is happening. So yeah, what this then says is before the call to see foo with parameter int and the return value int is called, so before the call expression is executed, the system out println about to call foo is going to be executed. Okay? You can also add something that we have not talked about so far, which is this formal thingy here. And this means that in there you can introduce formal parameters of your advice. This is like a formal parameter of a method in that sense. And what you can do with that is what you see here. So here we have again an advice, and in its before modifier we have an additional parameter in there, which is this int I. And you might wonder, well, what is that supposed to mean? And the same is the case for the weaver. It doesn't necessarily know how this I is corresponding to the actual target program. The way that you can connect that to actual things that happen in your machine is with this args clause. So adding that to your point cut designator will specify that the argument of the thing in question, which is here a method call, so the argument here is to be bound to some identifier I, which is taken from the list that came in here in the formals of the advice. So what that means is that I can now use this identifier I to access whatever has been given as argument for this, or whatever has been prepared as an argument for the call to this see foo int thingy. So what I can then do, for example, is I can start computing with that. This means that before the actual call to this see foo is happening, I will interject and take the value of the parameter and double that. So Another advice that I haven't talked about so far is the around one, which is an alternative to before and after. And as it says around, this is somehow a combination of the before and after with a little bit of a speciality in there. So around would mean that I would be able to specify code that executes before an event of an actual point cut is executed, and in the same way also specify something that happens after. And in order to be able to do so, I must specify within the block that belongs to my advice when the actual original event is supposed to be triggered. Like if I do an advice around a particular call, I will have to specify when where within my advice block I will do the actual call. So for our example here, I specify this around advice, and since this is about an actual call that has a return value here, I specify this thing also with a return value in order to fit into that pattern. So around with an int I. This int I is a thing that I would like to bind to a parameter of the call. So I add this args I, and no object. Okay. This came unexpected. So, well, maybe let's ignore that for now, that there's this object in there. I don't actually recall why this is here. I don't know. Do you remember? Is it because it's not a static function, but a member function? So maybe it's just a relict. So for now, let's just ignore that. So I also, I would say it's not necessary. So in principle, then what we can do now is we can bind this I to the parameter of the foo and access it then throughout our advice. So that's what we do here. We use it to double itself and then give it to the procedure here via parameter of the proceed term. This will do the original call and then return back some some kind of result, which we can then manipulate before we give that back again. So in that sense, we have scaled up our parameter and scaled down the result once again. So this could be one thing that you want to have for certain calls of certain methods. Yes?
Can you say again how foo knows that I is the parameter? Like if it had two ints, how would it know which one goes where?
So there would have to be more than one thing. So this args thing has an actual list of parameters.
And that's just passed to foo in the same order?
It's matched in that order to the call.
So
yes. So now that we have talked about like what kind of advice there is, and that there is point cut designators in principle and how they interact, what we haven't covered so far is the actual point cut designator primitives. So the actual clauses that you can use in order to specify the events that you want to catch with your advice. So, first of all, there was this group of method-related point cut designators, and we said that there is this idea of the call and the execution being separate things, with the call being the part that talks about the actual call expression on the side of the caller. So if we think in terms of control flow graphs, then there is the calling side like this one that would do something and then reach some program point, like program point one here, that is in front of an actual method call expression, and then transitions to the point after the method has terminated. So this is like the end of the expression, and then continues later on. So the advice, if specified with a call point cut designator and a before advice, would trigger at program point one, with an after it would trigger at program point two. If we specified as our point cut designator execution, we would wait for an event that reaches for a method of static signature that is given in the executions parameter. If whenever this program point 3, which is the start of the method call, is reached, then, this would trigger for a before of the execution. And if we have an advice after the execution of set signature, we would trigger whenever control flow reaches point 4. So, yeah, there you go. And as we have said already, the static signature of call and execution clauses might actually really differ in program code that is out there. So not every call signature, particularly in polymorphic code, is the same signature as the execution's signature. So if we overload override, for example, the toString method of some class, then we might have an object dot toString called at the call side, and only a call of that signature would match that particular call, whereas the execution would actually then dispatch to the overridden version of that. So if you're depending on what event we're actually interested in, we have to use the correct term here, either the call or the execution. So keep that in mind when you specify point cut designators. So the format for the method of constructor signature is what is given down there. So you have receiver type names, then so these here, which is a type name, and you have the actual identifier of the method name, and then again type names for the parameter. If you want to target the actual constructor, you use new for the name of the item that you put into the signature. Also, the ordinary method call will have a result type name that has to be specified. The constructor, of course, doesn't have something like that. So, there's an example for our method-related designators. We have a class, my class, here that does what I have proposed on the last slide. So it overrides the toString method from the object with a custom one. So this is the overridden toString method. And yeah, then we have a main method that tells us what the program actually really does. So first of all, there's a my class object created, and this is used in order to provide some output. So here the output that is produced is going to be C plus C dot toString. So there's a subtle difference in these two things. in that the second operand here has a toString attached to it before the whole string concatenation is performed. So now we also have an aspect added to the whole thing that specifies certain advices, or well, one advice and two point cuts. So there's two named point cuts, call to string and exec to string, and both of them refer to the my class to string method. One of them refers to its call, one of them refers to its execution. And we now add the advice down there to the system that is triggered before the point cut call to string or exec to string is done, and it just intervenes by outputting advice bang. So what's gonna appear at the output? So you say advice?
Yeah. You also have like advice and silly me as well.
So silly me plus silly me, so two silly me's in. Okay. So this is what's happening.
Three times.
So why is that? So the silly me's, I think, is pretty clear, because control flow will dispatch to two strings overridden version both of the times. So we have silly me added to the output. Why is there advice three times? So we said we have our aspect being specified for call and execution. These are two events that happen in there, and they happen at different situations. So before call would be at that situation, before execution is that location. So could be that a particular program execution passes both points, and both points triggering the point cut destination. And well, for our purposes, what we will see is we have one occurrence of my class two strings call being triggered. Say no. So this one. So this is the one over there. Okay? So because this is a direct mentioning of my class toString. Here, for the second parameter, we don't have an explicit toString being called on the whole thing. Instead, what happens is, underneath the hood, the concatenation here on something that is not a string will, first of all, consider everything as an object, then just call objects toString, and thus not explicitly my class toString. So there we don't have one of those things matching. But what then happens is we get the execution of the toString, because even though objects toString is not of that signature, we still dispatch to the actual candidate from my class toString. So this thing here then dispatches to this toString for this and for this. So the first toString for the, because it's directly mentioned here and directly called, this other one is implicitly done through the concatenation and the underlying implementation doing an object.toString, which then dispatches to toString. So these two are due to the blue one, this one is due to the red one. not convinced. I don't know whether it's exactly this one. That was maybe not so intelligent to do it like that. But two instances stem from like the blue and one instance from the red one. Yeah, so it's not necessarily this thing, but okay, good. What are the other point cut designators? So there's the ones that are related to field access or attribute access, and there is this get and set thing, and this doesn't necessarily mean that there is actual getters or setters involved. It's just whenever you mention a particular attribute's name in an expression, this already suffices to trigger this get or set action. So, what else you have to do there is you have to specify the signature of the some way of qualifying what attribute you want to catch here. So you give the type name together with the identifier for the field name and the actual type of the field, and with that you surround that with a get or a set in order to catch the respective event. However, if you then want to do something with this value, you still have to somehow bind a name within your advice to that. So this is another occasion where the identifier that you introduce within your before or after formals part plays a role. So for setting the X attribute of my class, for example, you can bind the name newval to the value that is bound to be set in as the new value of X, and then do something with that. So, for example, you can do the following. You can check whether the difference between the new value and the old value exceeds a certain limit. You can not proceed, but instead, for example, throw a new exception or something. Don't know how meaningful that particular example is, but with that, you have some ways of accessing the soon-to-be new value for the attribute. There's other point cut designators that are type-based. So there is the target of some type. Type or ID, it's called here, and this is actually not a static property, but this is like a dynamic property. So the type that you specify here in the target brackets are runtime checked for the concerning object identifier that is connected with this target thing. So this means that even if you are, for example, at a caller site and want to check for a particular caller's a particular call's receiver, whether it is of a certain runtime type, that is an instance where this target plays a role. So with that, you can, for example, match certain advices for polymorphic calls to a particular target, for example. So it can be quite useful in that sense. Then you have the within thing. This is a designator that will make the whole point cut trigger only whenever this event occurs. When the program is currently executing some kind of code that was specified within the class body of a particular type. So with that you can constrain the constrain triggering a particular advice to only a fraction of your actual code. So if you, for example, want to log only particularly the one particular class, you can, for example, add such a within clause and restrict all events to that particular thing. And then there is a similar point cut for the method body. So you can specify within code, and only if a particular point cut is reached throughout the execution of a particular method body, then this is only triggered. Then there are a few more flow-based mechanisms, even more flow-based than things like this within or within code, and which are the cFlow thing. And this is a very special one that matches join points that are conjoined with this particular point cut designator only after the start point of a particular point cut has been passed, but only until the endpoint of a particular point cut has not been reached so far. So what that means is, for example, if you specify this cFlow for the call expression for f here, this means that this advice is only triggered for all join points that happen after program point 1 is passed and before program point 2 has passed. So the join cuts that are specified by whatever follows this thing, this can usually be combined with some other things to make a more complex thing, will only be matched with everything that is reached between those two points. So with that you restrict everything to that. This is more than just this within code or within a particular class, since of course the code that is executed at runtime might at some point leave your particular class and execute code from somewhere else. With this cFlow thing, you make sure that still all the join points that are passed during that time are also considered for being matched up until you go back to your original specified point cut and pass its final stage, like this program point 2. And then there is the last one, which is like the most generic one of all of those, which is this if expression. And with that you can specify freely whatever condition you would like to use for being evaluated at each and every join point that is passed. And when I say each and every join point that is passed, this means that, well, it's really going to be executed everywhere in your program. So this is also a very dangerous point cut designator to be used, because this means a lot of runtime overhead happening, because the actual condition in there needs to be evaluated at every point that is passed, and this incorporates all the calls, all the executions, all the attribute accesses, all the exceptions, everything. This can be quite a lot. So an example for that, How would that look like? That's what you find over there. So that's before specified as this thing here, where you have an if designator that will access the current join point, and then there is a syntactical element in order to refer to your current join point, which is this join point thingy. And from there you can start your condition evaluation by exploring whatever your working environment completes for this thing. So there's this get kind, which gets the kind of join point for that, and that you can then match whether that is a method call, and then you can attach within my class thingy, and then you get all the method calls from within that happen within my class, for example. And well, that is a way to specify that I want to match all calls within a particular class. However, this might not have been the most efficient way of doing that, since there is an actual real designator for calls that you can equip with, like wildcards, and with that you get almost the same functionality, but don't execute that on, for example, attribute accesses or exceptions that happen and all that. So, yeah, this is quite inefficient when used in this way here. So, with that, we have all the designators that I found particularly interesting. So, you might now wonder, when I set up a complicated system of advices in my aspects, and yeah, well, I might end up with my point cuts having like an intersection of some kind. So when I reach a particular join point, then I might trigger several advices, and now I might wonder which advice is actually getting the precedence, particularly when I have systems like logging and some manipulations for like security issues in there. I might wonder which of them gets to work first on the example. And well, this is what we, for one point for example, can specify within our aspect-oriented system by precedence declarations. So if such a thing is part of your aspect-oriented program, then you can specify that the advice A, for example, has precedence over or the advice in aspect A has precedence over the advice in aspect B. So with that, you can have like a global specification precedence on complete aspects in that sense. So you can specify that the security issue aspect has precedence over the logging facility, for example, if that is your desire. There's also things that we haven't seen in here, where you can introduce the concepts of sub-aspects in the same manner as we have a class being a subclass of something else. So you can have like one aspect extend the other, and for those it's pretty similar as for overridden methods. The advices defined in the sub-aspect have precedence over the advice in the parent aspect. And well, if in every other case, well, there is no clear specification, so there might happen anything in there. For advices of the same aspect, there is the order in which they appear within the aspect itself is playing a role in there. At least if you are talking about these before specified advices, for the ones that are specified with an after, then the ordering is turned around in that sense. So, well, since before and after in are in certain sense like the opposite, the order is in that sense also opposite. Okay. So, how is all of that implemented? Well, we've already talked about different ideas of bringing that to work by, well, for example, introducing another step of code generation into the whole system where the Weaver starts working on source code of the original project together with source code of the aspect, and then produces new Java sources where the aspects are woven on source code level into the original class specification and then go through an ordinary Java compiler. There's also implementations where the weaving happens not at the source level nor at the bytecode level, but in the runtime engine, where the runtime engine would be the one that catches particular events and then gets the advices from the aspects in either bytecode or already compiled version and then inserts them in there. But the one that has been most successful of all of them is the one where the Weaver works on the actual bytecode level itself, where it would scan for particular patterns that have to do with function execution, function call, exceptions, and attribute access. So that's what we're going to see in here. So the different weaving techniques we have seen was like the preprocessor that would generate Java code for Java compiler to be fed with. And during compilation, we haven't seen, or I haven't talked directly about that, but the actual Java compiler could be manipulated so that the aspects are woven into during compilation. Of course, that can be done. Then there's the post-compiled processor, which would keep the aspects and the original program apart, and then after the original program is compiled, it would patch the bytecode files with whatever the aspects have been specifying. Then there is the virtual machine version that would do the whole patching through during runtime, and then there is different approaches that combine aspects of one with the other. But so the one that is mostly used is the one where the bytecode or JVM code is patched, and this would work, for example, here for setting of a particular attribute in that. So this is the thing that would would have to be manipulated due to this set of const val being being a point cut that is used in this advice here, and this means that on the bytecode level there will be the put field instruction. This is a thing that you can just find in or grab in your bytecode file together with a specification of which field is actually meant, and this hash 54 is usually a thing that is in the string pool of your program somewhere and can be looked up, and the decompiler here has done the work already for us, and this means that this hash 54 will yield that this is the field const.val of type integer, and this matches with int const.val from over there. So this is the place where we have to adapt our bytecode, and this is done in the way that we see down there. So there's two lines added to the bytecode. this is invoke static that will dispatch or will call my aspect dot aspect of, which is like the central dispatching facility in each of these aspect thingies that is used for obtaining the actual concrete advice that is used at that particular situation. So this is usually fed with some kind of designator for what the advice should be, and then the whatever comes from there is then invoked, and this is what this one does. So yeah. Oh, sorry. What's given back is of course a reference to the actual advice itself, and this is then used in order to perform the invoke virtual. So this needs to reside on the stack before, and from that you can then do this before from my aspect of some kind of internal hash that codes this particular advice, and this will then trigger the execution of that part here. Good, so everything that was needed was some kind of beacon that would show us the way where the join point is, and this is in our setting for the setter here, this put field JVM instruction, and then we can just inject this invoke static and invoke virtual and be done. So the attribute advice thing is quite easy to do in that sense. Then there is the call, like this one in here, and for this it's also quite an easy task, because calls, well, depends on whether they are static or dynamic. You have to look at invoke static or invoke virtual, so you can scan your bytecode for invoke virtual and then look up the supplied additional information like this sharp 33, which can be looked up in the string pool of this thing and be translated into like this object.toString, and gives back like this Java string, and this well matches with the pointcut designator call here and its signature. So this is objects to string, like here, object to string, and gives back a string like this string here. So this is a candidate for matching. The only question is now, well, if I am interested in matching, for example, that particular target thing, I need a little bit more work to do, and this is what is done, for example, in the shown code here also. So what is added here is the, well, probably the load from before should also be added, so you retrieve a reference to the object that you're interested in with this load thingy. You do an instance of test with something from the string pool, which is the here the name of the class that you're interested in. So this is this expression thing here, and then if they are equal, then you. Oh, if they are equal, you do like this part here. I'm not so sure whether the code here matches the aspect actually. So in principle, you would add like a test of whether they are equal or not, and then if they are equal, you would then dispatch to the advice with these two things, thus reaching this one, and in case that the whole thing is not matching, you would just jump over and perform the actual original method in that sense. So here with if equal branching to this thing here, as far as I remember the semantics of if equal, this would encode like a not target of expression, but so maybe this was not completely in sync with the example from above. But in principle, you see, you don't have to put a lot of work in there. You just have to look for this invoke virtual thing, and if it matches this particular signature, you decide to then add the next test a little bit in front in order to only filter for those that do match with the target thing. Okay. A little bit of complication is there if you have this around and proceed type of advice. So for that, this might be a little bit difficult. Well, why is that? Well, let's have a look at this one here. I think this is not this is not the one that I wanted to talk about. The one that I wanted to show is in principle this one here. So the thing is that with this proceed thing, this works fine as long as this proceeding is done within the actual advice that is called throughout this around thingy. However, since you are free to use like ordinary Java code in here, nobody just says that this is gonna be executed exactly at the point that's specified here, but you could also just move the call of the proceed to some later point in time, for example. So with that, the actual call to F that has been interjected by the advice might defer the complete execution of the thing, which means that all the infrastructure around needs to be kept intact until this thing is happening. An example for that, how that could be, is that you could use the proceed, for example, within a lambda expression like this one here, and then move that into some kind of thread pool in order to be executed later on. So with that, the proceed expression itself is syntactically occurring within the around advice. However, the actual execution of that thing is not happening at the point where it happened before the whole specification of the advice has been, but at some point later on. We don't even know exactly when this thing is gonna be happening. Just later on, as soon as this get cached value, for example, is then executed, only then we force to wait for the execution of this proceed thing again. So this might be a little bit of a problem for the code generation phase, because in the case where the execution of this of this method is deferred, in that sense, you still need to keep around everything that this proceed has access to, and in order for that to work, you need to carry around like the original object for which this had been specified, together with the parameter, and store it in some way like this params array that you can use in order to put it into a closure to give to the object to be executed later on. So yeah, there's a little bit of ugly code being produced around, and I think it's a little bit too much to talk about the actual details in that time that we have. Instead, I want to look at the issues that the more flow-dependent things like this if or the C flow impose on the implementation. So we've talked about this C flow thing being the specifier that would tell that that we select join points based on whether they trigger between two predetermined points of interest in our program flow, particularly what we define here within the C flow. It would be a call expression to some F, which would mean that between the start point 1 and the end point 2, everything that is reached around there is like taken into account for being a candidate for triggering this particular advice. And the standard approach for implementing something like that would be that you would have to actually, at each of the call matches that you find in the flow of the program, you would actually have to check whether this particular call is happening in the context of, well, the program having passed the start of a call to F and not yet reached the end of a call to F. How can you check that? Well, you can do so at runtime by going, for example, through the runtime stack and checking whether you're currently in a stack frame that has to do with this method call, for example, analyzing all the positions in all of the so far open stack frames, whether this is due to an expression that matches this particular call expression, because we don't have an actual execution but call expression here. So this is even more tedious to do. So this is quite bad in terms of runtime performance if you have to check for that at every call expression that you find somewhere. I mean, it's not necessary to be, to have an actual call expression here. It could also be like an attribute access or anything else. So depending on what you specify over here, this the execution of the cflow property here could be really, really bad. So how can you optimize that a little bit? Well, there is the idea of, well, the naive one is the stack-based one, which would be like the way to check that property without any particular helper. If you already know that such a thing might occur, you might be tempted to keep during runtime some kind of data structure that tells you whether you whether a function call expression that you meet happens at a time where we are already in control flow between start and end of a particular pattern or not, and we can do so by representing that with a state machine in that sense. So what we would do for that would be to define like a state. We have passed the start of a particular C flow point cut, or we have not yet started such a thing, and only in events that really trigger a change in that state, we would modify that. So when we pass like a call expression of that form, we would then change our state to we are we have now started with a control flow passing the start of this call to fint, and only when we pass the end of such an expression, we would then modify the state back to its original one. This works quite fine as long as we don't have like nested calls of this f thingy, and in order to cope with that also, we not only need like a state machine, but we also need to keep a stack of these states in order to be able to cope with nested versions of these things. So we introduce states for like the all C flow expressions in there and their different patterns. And in case that we hit a particular event during runtime where a join point corresponds to one of these C flow patterns, we modify or introduce a new state, push that on our stack, and only whenever we meet a closing event for a particular pattern, we then remove that state again from the stack and be done with that. And well, then it's a lot more easy to check for these properties, since we can directly check only this special purpose stack for whether a particular thing is opened or not, and be done with that. So that is like the optimization that you would like to do for this property-based cross-cutting. And for the if one, well, that's even more stressful, because you would have to introduce some kind of state for particular evaluation of a Boolean property, and well, this will explode quite easily for complexity of implementing some state abstraction for that. Anyway, this is like the insight into aspect-oriented programming that I wanted to give you. What have we talked about? Well, there's this advice that can be parameterized with after and before, and maybe even around. And so this can be arbitrarily complicated depending on how the underlying target structure looks like. We've talked about the concept of join points and how to locate them in the underlying Java bytecode. We've talked about dynamic dispatching that maybe needs like runtime tests in order to detect whether we actually have to trigger a particular advice or not. And we've talked about the implications of flow-sensitive point cuts that remove like a few of the costs that come from evaluating those without any additional data structures. So that's kind of that. So for aspect orientation, we have seen that this has some benefits, like you don't smear your concerns through your class hierarchy, but like untangle the concerns in certain entities and keep them apart from each other. You can even extend already existing systems quite easily if you specify your point cut designators liberally enough. You can just retroactively add that to your complete class hierarchy without a lot of problems. And with that, aspects like look like another level of abstraction separate from what your object and class oriented code looks otherwise. This comes with a few contours, like weaving generates a little bit of runtime overhead. You have seen that there, for a few of the point cut designators, there's a few runtime checks necessary in order to work, like type-based ones that have to add instance of tests, or ones that are flow-dependent or have completely open conditions, like the if ones. What also, of course, is added to your system is that what you might if you just look at your original object-oriented code, you just don't see any call that happens due to your aspects being woven into your system later on. This all depends on nice support from your surrounding IDE. So the IDEs that are used for aspect-oriented programming usually put some artificial markers in the carrier code whenever you have specified a particular point cut designator in your advice that matches with a particular location in your source code, in order to make like this control flow that otherwise might surprise you a little bit more obvious. So you get like little icons in your ordinary code that will show you, well, this is a potential match with your advice that you specified later on and might call that particular method. But if you just look at your plain source code files, you won't have any reference to the advice that is executed at all. And, well, depending on your IDE that you use, that might be a bad thing to have. If you're more interested in aspect-oriented programming, here's a few things that I have used for creating these slides. Otherwise, well, just get yourself, I think it's mostly Eclipse that implements this aspect-j thingy, so get the correct plugin and just start trying it out. It's quite nice to have these things. So with that, I think I'm done for today, and yeah, wish you a nice week.